The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. We're starting off today with Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on how American democracy was designed and how it's practiced in the real world. We've had a number of questions about the powers and function of the Supreme Court, which sits at the pinnacle of the judicial branch of government. Specifically, we've been asked about whether and how Supreme Court decisions can be overturned. Does any person or organization or branch of government have the authority to change the established law of the land? Our guide today is Linda Monk, a constitutional scholar, journalist, and author of User's Guides to the Constitution and to the Bill of Rights. Linda, welcome to Civics 101.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And Civics 101, we can always use a refresher course, all of us.
With that in mind, we're starting with some basics. How is the Supreme Court laid out in the Constitution?
Well, it's laid out in Article 3. There are seven articles in the original Constitution. Article 3 is the judiciary, and maybe no surprise, it's the shortest article, meaning the least words are given to them. In fact, Alexander Hamilton, everybody's favorite Broadway musical star now, said that the judiciary was the least dangerous branch because they had neither force nor will, but only judgment. So of all the branches of government, they're the most dependent on we the people giving them the support that they need for the role of an independent judiciary.
Very short explanation of the Supreme Court. How about required number of justices?
That, too, has changed throughout history. They've been as little as five and as many as, well, close to 9 to 11, sometimes 10. It's varied by statute. According, Congress has the power under Article 3 to designate the number of justices. It's not set forth in the Constitution directly. And as you probably remember, FDR during the New Deal had a very famous court packing plan, and the people were in favor of his policies, which the Supreme Court was striking down. But when he actually tried to change the number of courts, the people rallied in favor of the court, which was very surprising at the time. So that's a great example of where even when the president pushes back, even a popular president, if the president pushes too hard, the people like this notion of an independent judiciary that is set up in the Constitution.
We do have these three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, the judicial. Is it fair to say that the Supreme Court gets the final word for all of those three branches?
Well, there's another avenue to that, which is we the people. We may not be a specific branch of government, but we're the first three words in the Constitution, we the people of the United States. We have the ultimate power in the determination of what the Constitution means through constitutional amendment. So even the Supreme Court doesn't have the final word. And we the people have in fact enacted constitutional amendments that overturned Supreme Court decisions, the Dred Scott decision being the most notable, which said that no African-American, free or slave, could ever be a citizen of the United States. And in the 14th Amendment, about 10 years later, we the people say all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and the state in which they live.
A Supreme Court decision can be overturned by a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
How about just a new law, a legislature?
No, a legislature cannot overturn a Supreme Court decision that's based on the Constitution. The Supreme Court also makes decisions that are based on statutes. That's the lower level of law that Congress passes. For instance, the most recent one, or one of the more recent ones, had to do with equal pay. A woman named Lilly Ledbetter was trying to get back pay for 20 years in which she was paid less than male cohorts. The Supreme Court ruled that under the law as it existed at the time, she couldn't get all that back pay. Then Congress passed a new law, guess what it was called, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, that enabled women going forward to be able to get all that back pay. So that was a Supreme Court decision that was based on an underlying statute that then Congress changed the statute to countermand how the Supreme Court had ruled about the interpretation of that statute. But once we get into the Constitution, where we're talking about search and seizure or rights to gun control or a woman's privacy in her body, any of those constitutional rights, if the Supreme Court cites that in its decision, Congress can't override that because it's based on the Constitution. The only thing that can override it is a constitutional amendment.
Can the Supreme Court overturn congressional legislation?
Oh, absolutely. That's their job one. If it conflicts with the Constitution, when that's what was really established in Marbury versus Madison, was that the court had the power to say what the law is. And what they did in that decision was to strike down the Judiciary Act, which had allowed a lot of these judges to be appointed, and said that if you had a problem with that, you could appeal directly to the Supreme Court, whereas the Supreme Court is supposed to be an appellate court, and only Congress can change the jurisdiction, but still within what the Constitution did. And so the Supreme Court struck down that Judiciary Act because it expanded the court's jurisdiction contrary to what the Constitution said.
So can the Supreme Court overturn a previous Supreme Court's decision?
If it's based on the Constitution and not a statutory law.
Okay, so what would an example be of that?
That's happened quite recently. Bowers versus Hardwick had established that state laws that outlawed sodomy, and depending on your view, the listening audience, you can define that on your website, but it was a law that applied to sexual conduct. Michael Hardwick had a criminal conviction because of that, and the Supreme Court upheld that criminal law. Then later, in Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Kennedy on the court led the majority, again 5-4, saying that such laws were unconstitutional. So, and that happened within a period of about 10 to 15 years.
Okay, so how about with the case of Dred Scott? Since the Dred Scott case was overturned by constitutional amendment,
and the Civil War. We need to put that little part in there, too.
Yes, there was that. There was that scuffle. But so that ruling has never been officially overturned by the Supreme Court itself.
No, it didn't have to be, because a constitutional amendment came along. That's the highest, you know, form of authority is the Constitution. The Supreme Court's supposed to interpret the Constitution. So when we the people pass a constitutional amendment that countermands a Supreme Court decision, they have to obey that amendment. They have to obey the Constitution.
Okay, so I really do admire your faith in we the people. But let's just dig into this idea that increasingly we the people's legislators are not necessarily acting on laws, and many things are getting kicked up to the Supreme Court and therefore politicizing this judicial body that is supposed to be independent. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Let me make a clarify about we the people. I'm not saying we the people are always right. I'm saying that we the people always have the ultimate authority. Now, in terms of the politicization of the court, some people would say it's always been political, and you can look back through its history there. Usually people who disagree with what the court's saying are saying the court's political. People who agree with it saying they're following the Constitution. So you have to be careful about those terms, too. But I would say, and this is the heart of your question, Congress doesn't want to take responsibility. That has always been true from the beginning of the Republic. Congress, in Article I, has the most words given to it. The framers thought that Congress was going to be the dominant branch of the U.S. government, fully intended it. By the framers' vision, the president has way too much power today. The people, their closest connection to government is through their elected leaders, whether it's the House, the Senate now, or the president. And that's the most direct avenue that the people have, is through their elected leaders and participating in nominations for Supreme Court justices.
If this is based on we the people's voice and constitutional law and not politics, then why do those nominated to the Supreme Court matter so much and divide so politically?
Well, that's a good point. And there are plenty of constitutional scholars who believe that law is politics, that it's just politics in a different realm. And if you, like me, I don't think politics is a dirty word. Politics is our values. The problem is that we disagree about those values. And what the Constitution ultimately tries to do is say, okay, here are some core values, most of them in our Bill of Rights, that we don't think should be subject to a majority vote. And there are also structural guarantees in the Constitution that are not subject to a majority vote. For instance, like the Emoluments Clause that people are upset about with President Trump. That's in the Constitution. It's not supposed to be up to what the majority thinks. So in terms of politicization of the court, I think the people who are the most ideological, who really care the most about their values, understand that a Supreme Court appointment is really critical because they have life tenure. Now, in 1787, that might be 10 or 15 years. Today, it could be 30, 35 years. That's a long time to have that kind of power. And in fact, one of the leading constitutional amendments that's proposed is to limit the term of the Supreme Court to 15 years, period. And then perhaps there wouldn't be quite so much ideological debate about who gets the court seat.
Linda Monk, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Monk, she's a constitutional scholar, journalist, and author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, and The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. She was also series advisor on Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. There's more on her at wordofmouthradio.org. This episode of Civics 101 was produced by Molly Donahue and edited by Taylor Quimby. You can sign up for our podcast and deepen your knowledge of civics and hopefully use that in civic engagement. You can also sign up for our newsletter. It's called Extra Credit, which gives you more information and even little quizzes about what you learned on the Civics 101 podcast. Go to civics101podcast.org. We're also on iTunes and on Google Play. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last March, Batman vs. Superman hit the big screen in multiplexes across America.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
You're psychotic.
Whoever you chose to side with, that movie was a critical flop, reaching just 27% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Over the years, Batman has taken his fair share of criticism on his sharp chin from fans and critics alike. But which Batman are we really talking about? The scrappy guy bent on avenging the death of his parents at the hands of criminals? The smarmy playboy played by Adam West on TV? Or maybe the brooding Dark Knight who growled his way through the 90s? In nearly 80 years of fictional life, Batman has reflected the aspirations and anxieties of America's changing culture. He is, as Glenn Weldon observes, a bat-shaped Rorschach blot for us to project meaning upon. And among the most influential projectors of his bat personality, nerds. Glenn Weldon is an author and panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. I spoke to him last year when his book, Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, first came out. It's now in paperback. So who was the original Batman?
Well, he doesn't look too different from who he is today, but he only lasted about a year. He premiered in 1939, and for about 11 months, he hopped around rooftops of what was then New York City, in a, you know, a bat getup. He was basically a ripoff of The Shadow, the very popular radio and pulp novel character. There were a lot of ripoffs of The Shadow running around comics back then, and he wasn't even the only bat-themed one. But that just made him a very violent Avenger of the Night who basically killed a lot of the folks that he was up against. He developed a reputation very quickly for tossing goons off of roofs to their deaths. That didn't last long, though, because comics were for kids. And as soon as Robin was introduced, about a year later, He fundamentally changed.
So Robin began after the war, so did this lavish millionaire lifestyle, and so later did the introduction of Batgirl. Why was that? What was the perceived appeal of all of those attributes?
Well, as soon as Robin was introduced, and again, he was introduced only about a year afterwards, sales doubled. Because, A, he lightened the tone, and the parents' groups were starting to get worried about Batman. They were starting to get worried that he was killing all these folk. So they introduced Robin to, A, lighten the tone, and, B, to give kids, who were then the primary audience, somebody to identify with. And that doubled sales. It also gave him somebody to kind of work against visually. You know, red and green pops if you're up against a guy who is in very dark clothes. It also turned him from a very violent vigilante into basically a cop in a cape, a very smiling, happy-go-lucky kind of time traveler and space adventurer. Because for about those 30 years after he was introduced, comics were totally for kids. So they introduced all of these other aspects, the Batgirl, the Batape, the Batwoman, the Batdog in the 50s and 60s, because frankly, people were worried about Batman and Robin. They thought something was up between those two guys. And for a period of time in the mid-50s, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Frederick Wortham famously attacked the comic industry for what he saw as its role in fostering juvenile delinquency. And when he testified in front of Congress and in a book that he wrote, he basically said, what's up with Batman and Robin? He said, Superman is kind of a fascist. He said, Wonder Woman looks to me like a lesbian. And there's something going on here between these two men who hang out in this amazingly sumptuously appointed mansion. So as soon as that registered, the publishers of Batman started throwing all these other people into the mix, so that instead of being the most famous double act in comics, they became part of an ensemble.
And the ensemble was on full display in the television series. Should I be ashamed to admit that was my Batman, the Adam West Batman, Glenn?
Virginia, it's my Batman, too. I grew up watching reruns of that show. And, you know, there's a lot of nerds, and I talked to plenty of them for this book, who revile that show because it doesn't take Batman seriously, which is the refrain you're going to hear a lot. I argue in the book that was its whole mission statement was to take Batman seriously. They took the 60s comics, which, again, were not particularly complex and were made for very young children, which had a very simple, implacable, silly approach, and they said, let's put this onto the big screen. Let's just cut and paste it. So we're going to put it onto the television screen, but we're not going to distort it. We're not going to make fun of it. All we're going to do is say, let's just pretend like this is the most serious Ibsen play we are presenting in the world. And doing that made it hilarious, made it funny. That show touches on something very important about this character, which is you can look at Adam West dancing the Batusi on the go-go floor, and you can look at Christian Bale, you know, kind of saying, swear to me, being very brooding, and you can tell that these are the same character. And it's not because of how they're dressed, and it's not because of what they do, it's because of why they do it. The motivation for this character is the key to his appeal, I think.
And also key to that transformation was nerd culture. This is a big part of the book, of course. You admit to being a nerd and a Batman fan, and that's something that came very clear to you when you were lining up to get a collectible Batmobile at Comic-Con in 2013, which I guess was kind of a turning point for you. What happened?
Well, I mean, that's when it was the first Comic-Con I had been to. It is, if you haven't been, it is overwhelming, pleasantly so. I looked around and saw a lot of smiling faces. I saw a lot of my people, but I also saw a lot of kind of cynical exploitation of my people, and you have to kind of come to terms with that. So, yes, I waited in line for an hour and 45 minutes to plunk down $60 for this chunk of extruded plastic that's the form of the 60s Batmobile, because I do feel a very passionate love for that series. That series, the 66 series, turned him into a public joke and was a huge fad. And then in 1970, the makers of Batman comics said, we need to do something. So they created a Batman who was the antithesis of Adam West, a polar opposite. He was mysterious, he was dark, he was brooding. And most importantly, and this is why I think the appeal to nerds is such a huge part of this character, they made him a nerd. They made him obsessed. And the readers of comics at that time were older than they were even 5 years before. They were teens and adults now, before they were kids. And these teens and adults collected their comics, bagged and boarded them, kept them pristine and away from sunlight. And at conventions, they would talk and debate over whose butt could get kicked by whom. And they would pore over this material as, like they were doing Talmudic study. They were obsessed as well. And I argue in the book that there's a resonance there, that we nerds recognize something in Batman that we don't necessarily recognize in other superheroes.
Who is your Batman? Maybe you came to know the Adam West character on television. Maybe you're a big fan of Christian Bale and Michael Keaton and others who played the Dark Knight. We're talking about how Batman as a character has evolved and accepted the projections of our culture, especially nerd culture, with Glenn Weldon. He's an author and NPR pop culture critic. His new book is called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. So you have this burgeoning nerd culture, speaking with each other and creating a culture around Batman, but also influencing the trajectory of Batman that's picked up on by Tim Burton, for example, Christopher Nolan, this dark Batman. How does nerd culture feel about the rest of mainstream catching on, and especially these films? You had some pretty funny notes about what people had to say.
Well, sure. I mean, you can go on to, I found some fanzines back in the day that talked about how nerds were always suspicious of the thing that they loved being taken out of the medium that they loved, the comic book, into another medium, whether that was television or movies. And it's very interesting to see how much Hollywood has learned about nerds. Back in the Tim Burton era and the Joel Schumacher era especially, these directors would come to this material and say, yeah, this is kind of silly. I'm going to dispense with this convention and this convention and this convention. And that engendered a huge backlash. People were up in arms over the casting of Michael Keaton in that Batman film. They wrote in, they had petitions, they came close to boycotting the film. Of course, they didn't, because at the end of the day, what nerds want, what we all want, is validation. The fact that the mainstream accepts this thing means that all of a sudden, this thing that we have prized in our own little way out of the in the darkness at the edges of the culture is now as publicly accepted as sports. And that's a new experience for us. So by the time the Christopher Nolan films came around, Hollywood studios had learned their lesson. And they made sure that everybody in that cast and in that crew could quote chapter and verse of which comics that those films drew from. And that made nerds feel very, very protective of the Christopher Nolan films. All of a sudden, they felt like these were ours. And that also leads to the downside of nerd culture, which I do touch on in the book, this toxic aspect of it. When the very first criticism came out of one of the Batman films that was less than a rave, and it wasn't a pan, it was basically just saying, eh, this isn't for me, that guy, that critic, got death threats because nerd culture circled the wagons. So we've gone from being on the outside and critiquing Hollywood to many of us defending Hollywood against the critical establishment.
Well, it's not just the nerds, of course, that are passionate about Batman, but the norms. Many people, as you point out, consider him to be a relatable figure. I mean, he wasn't bit by a radioactive spider. He's a regular human being. He's not a god, which sets him apart from other superheroes. But you also point out that that's kind of ridiculous in a way. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I talk to a lot of nerds, and I heard over and over again that, you know, Superman is entitled. He has these gifts that he had nothing to do with, and he's super powerful, and he can do anything, but Batman's my guy. Batman is human. He's relatable. And I would point out to them, politely, that he has a superpower that you seem to be overlooking, which is wealth. This unimaginable, vast, limitless wealth, which makes anything possible. It explains away all the headquarters, the gadgets, the ride, the costume, everything about him. It works essentially in any given Batman story as magic. And as soon as you acknowledge that, I think you understand this character a little bit better. But I think that there's something about that, Virginia. I think that in America, at least, everybody feels like we could become a billionaire if we just try really hard. So we look at a character like Batman, and the fact that he is separated from us by billions and billions of dollars doesn't necessarily register.
Also, there are so many gritty, dark interpretations of Batman that are really popular now. But one of the things you point out in the book is that he is motivated by hope, not revenge. So why all the darkness?
Because there's this old saw, Virginia, that the comics you read and loved as a kid are the comics that stay with you. And, you know, the best comics in the world, if you ask anybody, are the comics they were reading when they were 12. And I think that there is, if you look at this character and see only the grim, gritty, ultra-violent machismo, you're getting the view of this character that the fanboy has, the adolescent fanboy has. But the important thing about Batman is not that. The important thing about Batman is that when this terrible blow is dealt with him, and I'm talking about the origin, which we've all seen way too many times by now, but when his parents are killed, he doesn't go after the mugger. What he does is he transforms this terrible act, this trauma, into an act of self-rescue. He devotes his life to not just going after that guy, but to stopping crime, to ensuring that what happened to him can never happen to anybody else. He's dedicated himself to this idea of never again, which is a very childish notion. It's a very unrealistic notion. But again, superheroes exist on the level of ideals. They are things to which we aspire. We identify with them, sure, but they work on an emotional and a psychological level.
Well, your observation is that the Batman character goes through these cycles of light to dark pretty much generationally, like 30-year cycles. So maybe we're hitting peak grid and you think it might turn back?
I think that's inevitable. I think, you know, I haven't seen the Zack Snyder Batman versus Superman film yet, but it certainly seems like he's motivated by the notion of this grim, gritty guy who can beat up folk a lot. And that's a part of him, and that is something that really in the 90s became huge. But there's more to him than that. And the fact that you're seeing DC Comics and a lot of other people making fun of the Batman persona, in the Lego movies, Will Arnett plays Batman as a guy who is obsessed with darkness and death metal. The fact that we are now making fun of Batman, not because he's square, as we did in the 60s, but because he is so serious, I think is growth. And I think that is inevitable, that we're about to see a changing of the cycle.
Okay, Glenn, you going to tell us your pick? You've also written a book about Superman, Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You can look at this on one level as the ultimate jock versus nerd fight, right? Jock has the raw power. Superman's got, you know, the abilities, the strength. Batman has the gadgets, the strategy, the cunning. So in any battle between jock and nerd, I am definitely on Team Nerd.
That was my earlier conversation with the author Glenn Weldon. You'll find a link to more on his book, Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Poddington Bear, and Ari De Niro. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And we invite you to check out our fleet of podcasts, not just Word of Mouth, but also the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop and Civics 101. You can just search for them in iTunes or Google Play. And here's the thing with podcasts. They really do spread around by word of mouth. So we invite you to rate your thoughts on our podcasts on iTunes, because it is just one way to clue other people in to what you enjoy. Thanks for doing some squawking for us. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.